Welcome to Grim Scenarios. I am your host, Milk, and with me, as always, it's your other host, Emma. Hey, Emma!
How's it going, Milk?
Yeah, doing good. We're doing a little late night recording session here tonight, but it's Wednesday everywhere else, I'm sure.
The old jokes never die.
They never die. We're picking up with the second half of our Outsider tier list. Last time we rated everything up to the M's. I believe the last one we did was Moonchild, I want to say.
Yeah, so we didn't quite finish the M's. We started the M's, but we didn't. We got 50% through the M's, which is because M is the 50th percentile letter in the alphabet. 13th out of 26.
Which works perfectly.
Which works perfectly for the Outsiders, where randomly they split between the two M characters, Mutant and Moonchild.
But before we get into it, we just wanted to remind everybody that we're giving away a badge, a full weekend badge for Final 3 Con. That's April 25th, 26th, 27th, 2025 in Washington, D.C., and McLean, Virginia, anyway. And the way you enter for that giveaway is to email grimscenariospodcast@gmail.com with a tale of a time when another player was kind to you in a game of Blood on the Clock Tower. Make sure to include the email that's associated with your Tabletop Events account, and also make sure to include your Discord username so that we can contact you on Discord to let you know if you've won.
Yeah, we're really excited about this. We want everyone to be thinking about kindness and Blood on the Clock Tower, and we decided that one of our small ways of doing that would be to encourage you to think of a time where someone else was kind to you, and put that in a story. And if you don't have that story, well, that's a bummer, but you can make one up. It's not like we'll check it. It just has to be a story about kindness and Blood on the Clock Tower.
Yeah. And I think we've probably all experienced that even in a small way, you know?
Yeah.
So try to think about that. Try to think about the positive experiences that you've had playing the game, and share those with us, because we're really excited to hear those stories specifically.
Anyway, Milk, and you have until the end of November, November 30th at like midnight, when the clock strikes December.
We technically said December 6th.
Oh, we said December 6th. Never mind. You have more than the end of November. You have until December 6th when the clock strikes midnight, December 7th in Eastern time zone. Entries will close.
That's right.
But you have until then. We're doing it in November, but we tossed an extra week on.
And with that, let's get into the next one of our Outsider tier list. You know, it occurred to me after we did the last video, Emma, that we should have set ourselves up to be able to read what each of the abilities does when we talk about it.
Yeah, folks, someone in the YouTube chat asked us to do that.
And so we're going to do it. Right. So we're gonna go through and read the abilities this time, which we probably should have done before, but
yeah,
what a great comment. Thanks for the suggestion.
Yeah, we think about these characters a lot, we play with these characters a lot, we know what their abilities do just by looking at the icon. But not everyone has our knowledge or experience or depth, and we should do a better job of making this more engaging for people who have less of that. So, with that, we'll start with the mutant, whose exact ability text I will pull up.
And I will vamp during this part of the podcast, because that's what I'm good at. We didn't discuss in advance which of us was going to read the ability text, which was a mistake on our part. But since I already have since I already have six windows open for recording the podcast, I'm going to let Emma do the reading.
That makes sense. If you are mad about being an outsider, you might be executed. So this uses a keyword. So if you're unfamiliar with the mutant, you might have trouble grasping your hand on what that means. The keyword is mad. Basically, this means that if you are attempting to convince people you are an outsider, the storyteller can execute you. And of course, the mutant is an outsider, so that is a problem for the mutant. They have to convince people they are not what they are.
The mutant is a favorite of mine. I think a lot of people like the mutant as an outsider. It's quite a lot of fun to just sort of be claiming other things. On Sects and Violets, you generally aren't going to be claiming to be an outsider early in the game anyway. And of course, where you can get in trouble with the mutant as a good player is if you get into the mid and late game and start looking very suspicious because you're claiming a role that someone else is claiming and refuse to back off of that claim. You might look like you're evil. You might get executed and cost a kill for the good team. There's a lot of things that can happen with the mutant.
Yeah. When I'm playing mutant, I generally less worry about the double claim concern because double claims really aren't the end of the world. Most of the time, people will read double claims as minions or good players or mutants. So it's not the end of the world, generally. The bigger problem is you might need to get some quick thinking on your... The bigger problem in the double claim situation is you might need some quick thinking about how the hell you're going to get away with claiming that the person... Another good player who's claiming the same, another player you think is good, who's claiming the same role as you, is good, so you can focus on killing evil players. That's the bigger problem for the mutant.
Yeah.
In the double claim situation. But the real problem for the mutant is, I think actually you aren't in a double claim. You are in a unique claim, but your information doesn't check out. Because being in a unique claim, but having your information not check out is... something that happens typically candidate. With evil players.
Demon candidate material specifically. And it yeah. makes you a demon candidate, especially in the mid and late game, it can be a problem.
Strategy-wise, mutant's obviously incredibly open-ended. There's so many different things you can do it with it because it's a sort of... And this, I think, sort of gets into a lot of what we've discussed here in terms of strategy is... Strategy comes out of restrictions. Strategy type comes out of, like, things that change how you have to play, rewards that you, the things that reward you for playing well. And the mutant has a restriction, which gives it, like, goals beyond the normal clock tower player and space to play in those goals.
Yeah. It forces you to engage with the game in a different way, which is great. And I think, you know, we haven't talked about, we talked previously about, like, when do we talk about Fangu strategy with relation to outsiders? And I think it might fit best here talking about the mutant, which is that if you're an outsider from Sects and Violets, or another script that has a Fangu on it, you do have to think about what's going to happen if you do get jumped to by the Fangu. That's a piece of strategy that you... Even if you're not necessarily planning for it, you need to be aware that that change can happen to you, and you need to be able to adapt to it. We'll probably talk about it more when we get to Fangu, but it is something that as a mutant you might be thinking about when you're deciding what you're going to claim, what sort of information you're going to give out with your claim. People are more likely to see you as the mutant if you're claiming roles that don't give information or that give out information that's less damaging to town, as opposed to giving out information, you know, pretty consistently that's just wrong. So there's a lot of space with the mutant to try to do a lot of different things.
Yeah, and the mutant sort of has a leg up on other outsiders, of course, because it's already, in terms of receiving the Fangu jump, because it's... already heavily incentivized to try not to look like an outsider.
Yeah.
I mean, it's heavily, and unlike other outsiders, it's heavily incentivized to find a safe bluff before the jump happens. I think something that goes wrong frequently for evil teams in Fangu worlds, and one of the reasons why I think that the extra evil from the Fangu is... we're sort of on a tangent here, but I'm going to finish it because I started it. We've talked about this with the Pit Hag. We're going to talk about it again now. The extra evil from the Fangu is not always worth it. Evil teams, like, in situations where someone is blatantly an outsider, you don't want it becoming obviously a Fangu game, and then you jump to them. But the mutant is a little bit less at risk of that because the mutant is already incentivized to not look like an outsider.
I think when we do get to Fangu, we're going to have a very interesting discussion about the strategy involved in the Fangu and what mm-hmm. really it does and what its strengths and weaknesses are. But that'll be for later. That's a little teaser.
Yeah. I do think the mutant is a highly strategically interesting character. Just looking at what's left on the board for outsiders, I would be comfortable tossing it in as our fourth and final S tier outsider. I think it's the most strategically interesting of the ones that are left. I think it works nicely with what creates the interesting things about Lunatic Damsel and Butler in their own ways. Do you have any disagreements there, Milk?
I think it's the most uniquely strategically interesting. And what I mean by that is there are some similarities in specifically the Sects and Violets outsiders that sort of across the board, because of their home script, they have some similar play patterns. I think Mutant is the most, as you mentioned, incentivized to find that space where it looks like a townsfolk to have a great bluff. I mean, it's always the most fun as a storyteller, I think, and as a player sometimes, when you get to the grim reveal and you show who the mutant was and nobody knew. You know, nobody had any idea that that was the mutant the entire game. I think that's always kind of a fun space. So I actually agree with you. I think it fits into S tier very nicely. I think it aligns with the other minions that we've put in S tier, the other outsiders we've put in S tier. And I do think it has a lot of strategic choice.
Sorry, I was looking for my mic setup to mute because Artemis started howling. But then I realized it was my turn to talk. As I hit the mic mute button, I was like, oh no, now there's going to be some dead air because I have to unmute my mic now.
I think our viewers love hearing Artemis bark / howl / run around / whatever.
All right. So we've got mutant up in S tier. That means we can move on to the ogre. The ogre is, of course, one of the newer outsiders. It doesn't have a home script yet. There's actually technically two versions of Ogre that are officially released by TPI, so we'll talk a little bit about both of them. The one that's printed on the token, the default one, is on your first night, choose a player, parentheses, not yourself. You become their alignment, you don't know which, and that's again in parentheses, even if drunk or poisoned. And then there is an alternate rule version one that's released. Let me just find that text. It's... the alternate one is, there's no official text that goes with the alternate one, but it's just that the ogre stays the alignment whoever they pick, even if that player's alignment changes, which is only recommended for essentially big games, where having two extra evils might not throw things completely out of whack. So we'll spend most of our time on standard ogre, but we may make some comments about the difference in strategies and optional ogre. There's not a huge depth of difference in strategy.
I don't think the strategy changes substantially. I think the ogre strategy largely stays the same, although your adaptability as a player might have to change a bit.
I think that's right. It's basically And the ogre is one of my favorite characters, so I'm gonna. Say some things about it that are gonna make me feel sad, and then I'll remember this isn't a ranking of what characters are most fun, what characters are most interesting, are most balanced, which characters should go in the most scripts. It's a ranking of characters that have strategic depth. The ogre's strategic depth is not that high. It's you pick a friend on the first night, you try to help that person win, you try to keep them alive. You try to defend the worlds they're building. You want them to win. You don't want people who aren't... that's all you know in the game is you win if they win. So I think there's a lot of fun and interesting things you can do there. I don't think a lot of them derive necessarily from the ability, because the ability is just a very single-minded track. Help my friend win.
I think the strategy involved in Ogre is trying to figure out your friend's alignment. If they don't outright tell you, obviously, that they're evil, it could be kind of interesting trying to pay attention to what they're doing, trying to solve out whether you think that what they're doing aligns with the alignment that they've told you, if they're acting good, if they're acting evil. There's something in that. I think there's some strategic questions about when or whether you actually claim to be the ogre publicly or to players who aren't the player that you picked. Getting into some role swaps and stuff, I think, is empowered by like being the ogre and being trusted by the person you pick. It's not hollow. You know, it's not just the pick and then do whatever. But there is a limited amount that you can do beyond that. I would agree.
Generally, you're going to want to be a little shy about who your ogre friend is because, and even if you're the ogre, because you don't necessarily want people who aren't on your team to know the two of you are tied together. Particularly if you're evil, particularly if you happen to pick the demon, you really don't want that.
Yeah, especially if you, for example, pick someone and then they end up being outed evil, and then you're also outed evil, and then a third evil player decides to also be outed evil, that could be a bad situation for people who have chosen me as their ogre friend. Right, Emma?
I'm not sure what you're referring to, Milk, per se, but I think in some situations like that, the information necessarily made the ogre and the other player outed evil.
Yeah, it did.
The only question was whether the ogre friend was out at evil. And I think in some situations, you know, having the triple out at evil playing hide the demon, if none of those players are the demon, is quite strong. As noted, the evil team may win sort of games like that.
That's true. I think the core of my thought was adapting to what's happening in the game and how evil you might look and whether you might be able to look like a minion, whether you might be able to look like, you know, a demon candidate. I think being able to adapt to the changing situation is pretty important for the ogre, being aware of what's going on.
That's all true, I think, but it's also like, that's the same if you're just like an evil player bluffing Steward or Wash, or let's do Washwoman because everyone's played TV. If you're an evil player bluffing Washwoman confirming someone your evil team, which I think is an underrated play, people don't do it enough, like, you have that same sort of responsibility. It's not, like, something unique about the ogre. It's something that's unique about being evil is you need to sell your information it's unique about being evil and not the demon is you need to play and sell your information in a world that protects the person you care about.
Right.
Which is the demon. I think ogre does, like, create some wrinkles on that. I don't think it creates enough wrinkles for me to move it out of B or even C tier in terms of strategic depth. It's very one track.
I think maybe where my brain was starting to lean was also into the usefulness of ogre as a bluff. I don't know how useful it is as a bluff, though, because in theory, you would use it to align yourself with somebody, but if you're a minion, you're already aligned with the demon, and you may not want town to know that. So maybe you can use it to frame someone. That might be a kind of interesting way of kind of going about it.
I think with ogre as a bluff, you're normally going to want to pretend you've picked a good player. And then, you know, if you're a minion bluffing ogre, and you get caught as evil, it makes your friend look evil. If you're a demon looking, getting ogre, you want to obviously seem super good, like your friend.
Yeah, but I think that's probably right.
I think we do probably need to just slot ogre into a slot and move on. So, Milk, my heart wants me to find a reason to put it higher. My head says this is one of the lower strategically interesting minions or outsiders. So, I'm torn between C and B with a slight lean to C. But what are your feelings?
I'm hovering it over the C tier right now, but I initially moved it up to B. I think maybe part of the reason why I'm not sure is because there's a little bit of less experience with this outsider. I think I'm inclined to drop it in C for now with the thought that if I get more experience with it and playing with it more, you know, I think I've only pulled it once, maybe twice. So I think if I get more experience with it, I might have the thought to move it up to B. But I do think it goes into C for now. Not for funness, not for our love of it, but it doesn't have that much strategic value.
Okay. Let's go to the Plague Doctor. Another character I'm quite fond of. Another character I think is sort of very incentivized to be one-tracked. Plague Doctors want to live.
Yeah. As long as possible. Preferably to the end of the game.
Yeah.
Do you want to read the ability text?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sorry, I forgot that I'm supposed to be doing that.
That's okay. I'll just vamp while you're finding it.
Yeah. I had remembered to pull up ogres before we got to that part, but then I precisely forgot to get them. Plague Doctor's current ability attacks is, if you die, the Storyteller gains a minion ability. I actually think that might be changing to when you die, the Storyteller gains a minion ability.
Makes sense.
But functionally it's the same. As soon as the Plague Doctor dies, the Storyteller immediately gains a minion ability.
There's a bucket of associated jinxes as well, where minions gain abilities, but that's not relevant to the Plague Doctor.
Yeah, certain minion abilities that, like, functionally don't make any sense for a Storyteller to have, like Baron, Spy, Boom Dandy, Fearmonger, Goblin, Marionette, Scarlet Woman, Spy, because there's nothing the evil team gains out of that. Or I'll jinx that those abilities essentially go to a minion, except for Baron causes outsiders to be added. That's an active Baron. It's almost like an active Baron.
Yeah.
For those of you who like your memes. And Boom Dandy causes the boom explosion to happen immediately if the Plague Doctor is executed. Evil Twin is just strictly banned because there's absolutely no way to make that make sense. Notably, this can be an in-play minion ability. It used to need to be an out-of-play minion ability. That's no longer true. It can double up on things that are already in play, which is quite interesting, I think.
And
but
in terms of
I think this is like interesting from like a game perspective, much like how Ogre creates interesting games. The Plague Doctor themselves is just trying to live.
Yeah. It's a great bluff for the evil team. Good players probably aren't going to want to kill them. Not great for a demon necessarily, although maybe you can even make it work as a demon, but certainly as a minion, it's a fantastic bluff because the good team doesn't want another minion ability coming into play. I will say it's somewhat script dependent. There need to be minions on the script that the town is afraid of having a second one of, or a second ability in play of. I'm much more scared of a plague doctor putting a poisoner into play, a second poisoner into play, or a second like killing ability into play, or bringing a killing ability into play in the mid to late game. Giving an assassin ability, giving a psychopath ability, giving a witch ability. Then I might be of some of the other things. I think that's probably. I mean, there's the problem is so. I guess this is something maybe we could just talk about in brief. There's a bunch of outsider roles that want to avoid dying or that do something when they die. Some of them are more okay to die. Some of them are less okay to die. And we could argue back and forth about which are which. But the fact of the matter is that effectively, they all play with a kind of similar pattern of just trying to live as long as possible so as not to damage the good team. I think Saint and Sweetheart are the two that I'm thinking of, and we haven't talked about them yet, and we'll talk about them later.
Yeah. And Klutz is the other one. Klutz and Moonchild. We put Klutz in B tier because Klutz has to actively do something, find a good player. We put Moonchild in C tier because Moonchild cares a lot less about the alignment of the player they pick. Yeah. I think Plague Doctor probably lines up in C tier with Moonchild.
I agree with that.
And this is sort of convincing to me that we are a little harsh on Ogre and maybe we should move it up to B tier.
You know what? I'm fine to say that. Again, prospectively, I do think it might be a B tier outsider in terms of strategy. I do think there's more to do with it than Moonchild or Plague Doctor. So if it's not at the top of C, it's at the bottom of B, certainly.
All right. And any final thoughts on Plague Doctor, Milk?
There's not a lot of strategy. I mean, you know, use the same death avoidance tactics that you use anywhere else, right? Claim to be Demon Banes, claim to be something that the evil team probably won't want to kill, start knowings, things like that. but there's not a whole lot unique to the Plague Doctor's ability, right, that makes it more or less, or that makes it more strategic than sort of just doing that same thing.
Yeah, I mean, and frankly, that question was just a secret excuse for me to pull up the politician text.
Naturally.
Politician is, of course, politician's a character that is, I think, polarizing is the one way to put it. Its ability is, if you were most responsible for your team losing, you change alignment and win, even if dead. I think with politician, there's like sort of two questions that, like, I think are fundamentally going to drive for me, like, where we end up tiering this. And I think these are two sort of like the big giant warts of this character. The first one is the storyteller actually going to take the text of the politician token seriously? That is, are they going to actually make an informed judgment call about whether the politician was most responsible for their team losing, more responsible than the players on the other team for their team losing? Because if the storyteller is going to be soft-hearted about it, if the storyteller is going to let, like, a politician's going to flip to the evil team winning if with sort of weak effort, there's not much interesting thing with the politician. The second thing is this character fun? This is one of the characters that is, like, can have such dramatically unfun effects on games that it limits the strategic space the politician can play in.
I fully agree with the premise, I think, that you're presenting. I'm going to shy away from the question of whether the character is fun a little bit, because I think that that's playgroup dependent to some extent, script dependent to some extent. I think just pulling the politician token and immediately playing for the evil team for the entire game is very common. And I think there's more strategy in the question of whether the storyteller is actually going to adjudicate this character fairly in terms of its character text. The more tightly the storyteller manages that, the more interesting the politician becomes to me. Because I think it's quite a lot like Goon in the sense that you do have to have a good read of the game and of your impact on it. Not doing anything the entire game and then voting on the wrong person on final day probably isn't being the most responsible for your team losing, because the demon killed like 5 people to get you there. That seems more responsible for your team losing, the demon killing 5 good players. The pit hag making outsiders, even just at the most basic level, turning, you know, removing townsfolk information and making outsiders. The assassin stabbing a powerful townsfolk role. Those are all more important than your one vote, because evil may have had the votes at the end to do it. Maybe not. If you're the one vote that swings it, you know, that might do it. But that said, I do think that there's a lot of strategy involved in knowing whether you've done enough or whether it's time to cut bait. My imagination of the politician's, like, game from start to finish is you start disrupting things as much as possible because you're looking at the game and going, okay, I need to do stuff. So I'm going to see where I can, I'm just, you know, kind of trying different things, you know, double claiming somebody, doing this and that. And then as the game goes on, either you've found something that seems to be disrupting your team and you feel like you've kind of are pushing them in the wrong direction, or you feel like the evil team is struggling and you're really not doing much and it's time to cut bait. And I think that's the strategy involved in politician, is finding something interesting to do with it, finding something to claim, finding a way to impact the game, finding a way to impact the game massively for evil and try to win with them, or know when you just probably haven't done enough and it's time to play for your team.
Yeah, I largely agree with that. You know, the character is tricky. Like, the character's tricky. You know, I've story-told games where there's one game that comes to my mind where the evil team was doing a really solid job setting up an atheist world without even claiming atheist. Like, atheist was available for one of them to back into. And the politician, who really wasn't doing much to help that world, decided to pivot to atheist, like, at the time when an evil player would have needed to. And while the atheist win ended up happening, like, I didn't flip the politician because it wasn't really the politician claiming atheist. If anything, that helped the good team because it created players who, like, if they had thought through of it, needed to be evil who were actually evil.
Right.
The politician had sort of, like, even though I explicitly didn't flip the politician, I later heard the politician claim they had gotten the evil win there. And that sort of gets into the fun part of it, too, to a degree, but, like, what you actually have to do as a politician is, like, you need to be constantly hustling, constantly working, but in a way that keeps the game fun. And that's just such a tricky space for me. I do think this is a strategically interesting character if it's run correctly, if it's run well, if players, and if politician players are going to accept that the storyteller isn't always going to judge that they did enough, even if they tried. Like, if all those things are true, like, I think this would probably necessarily be in the S tier. I think those things are not true enough. I think it needs to go in the A tier.
I was going to say the same thing. I do think it goes into A tier. I think it's very similar to Goon. I think it has some elements that it shares with Heretic as well, in terms of, like, trying to make a team that's not yours lose. Trying to make a team that's not yours win, rather flipping win conditions and things like that. So I 100% agree with that. I'm going to actually just stick it on the sheet in between Goon and Heretic, which I think are related characters and have similar questions that we would ask about them. But I do think it's an A-tier minion. I do think it's an S-tier outsider that probably suffers a bit from people's ability to run it and be satisfied with the way that it's adjudicated by a storyteller.
And players' ability to, like, accept, like, fair adjudication of the politician.
Yeah. You know, you think you've had a bigger impact on the game than you have.
And you always do.
Has to judge that. And you always do.
Everyone.
You see your impact most.
Yeah. Everyone is the protagonist of their own story. If you're not the protagonist of your own story, like, that's a little sad. Like, you should be the most important person in your life.
That's some wisdom right there. I accidentally left Acrobat on this list, so I'm just going to move it down here.
Yeah, but you're not the protagonist of the game just because you think you're the protagonist of your story. And, like, knowing and understanding that is very hard for people, and that's one of the things that makes Politician, like, a character that's sort of beat down a bit by the unfortunate nature of the world that exists around it.
Main character syndrome.
Yeah.
Shall we get on to the Puzzle Master, Emma? I've got a little puzzle token here
we should get on to the Puzzle Master, which is, Puzzle Master is weird, and it's unique, at least among released outsiders, in that it gains explicitly information about the game in the sense, in the way a townsfolk might, in which the storyteller tells them something that the Puzzle Master knows to be either true or false. Its ability is one player is drunk. Even if you die, if you guess, parentheses, once, who it is, learn the demon player, but guess wrong and get false info. Did you like how I sort of vamped for the time for me to find the
ability really
text
good.
Milk?
I could tell that was what you were doing, and I was really proud of you and appreciative of the effort. So, Puzzle Master, I've been talking a lot. What are you thinking?
It's in a weird space that it's a character that can theoretically, it's an outsider that can theoretically solve the game by themselves. Well, not by themselves, because they need to talk with the other players and gain information and put together the best guess, and if they guess right, they solve the game. Though I think in a well-run in a well-designed Puzzle Master script and in a well-storytold Puzzle Master game, it should be basically impossible for a Puzzle Master to solve their puzzle drunk with any degree of reliability. Most of what you're trying to do is, you know, take your... is play your percents, and then you kill the person you get, and that closes world.
Yep.
Or you decide you can't play the percents, and you pick someone you're certain is sober, and you never kill the person you get.
Yeah, although many storytellers, if you intentionally guess someone you think is not the demon, may not give you the best information.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely, there's definitely, like, Puzzle Master requires you to do all the things that we like out of strategically interesting characters. It encourages you to pay close attention to the game state, encourages you to do different things, including the guess wrong on purpose. It encourages you to play percents and angles to get the best outcome for your team. It doesn't care about dying. It cares about staying alive in an interesting way, rather. Like, the drunkenness is there. It always exists. But you can only gain the benefit from the drunkenness if you stay alive, which is, of course, interesting for an outsider.
So, I think with the Puzzle Master, while it does have all those elements that we like in strategically interesting minions... God, why do I keep saying minions? In strategically interesting outsiders, it has a lot of interaction with the game. It has to pay attention. It has to think about what it's going to guess. The player is incentivized to talk to a lot of people. The strategy for choosing is going to necessarily come with a lot of red herrings, with a lot of you kill a player who's good, who was pointed at by the storyteller because they want you to remove someone who's useful, or kill an outsider who causes a problem for the town, or various different things like that. So yeah. I think it requires you strategically to make a choice that's very important with very little chance of getting it right. And so I'm not sure, even though it has those qualities and does cause you to engage with the game, I'm not sure how much the choices you make matter, I think, is the thing that I fear.
Yeah, I mean, you are playing angles and you are playing percents and you are, like... I think my gut is this goes in B tier. I think it's lower than what we have in A tier, but higher than what we have in B tier, so my inclination is it goes in B tier.
I think it goes at the top of B tier, yeah. It's not.
I think there's a lot of... You can imagine a townsfolk version of Puzzle Master that was less punishing... like that would be like an A tier strategic townsfolk, but partially because Puzzle Master is designed to hurt the good team, that gives the storyteller the license to like limit the benefits you can get from playing your angles well. I think it lands in B tier for me.
I think it lands in B tier for me as well, and again, largely because I'm not sure how much your work pays off in most cases.
All right, next up is, of course, the Recluse Classic TB Outsider.
One of my favorites, like, overall, in general, because it does seem to appear on a lot of my scripts.
it's a powerful script-building tool, and that's because its ability is you might register as evil, and as a minion or demon, even if dead. Now, there's some evidence that that and is an or, but in 99% of cases, that and is an and, just for rationality's sake as a storyteller. Like, most of the time, there's almost no times when you'd ever register as a recluse as evil, but not a minion or a demon.
Yeah. I think I'll jump in on Recluse, because I think it has some things in common with other outsiders that we've talked about already. And I'm specifically thinking about Plague Doctor and the suite of I don't really want to die because I damage town in some way minions. Now, on trouble brewing, and I think that's a good place to start. The recluse can damage information from the fortune teller while alive, from the investigator, from the empath. It can damage information from a dead raven keeper. And after dying, it can damage the information of an undertaker.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a lot of damage it can do both while alive and dead on trouble brewing. It's useful sometimes to out as the recluse when you start getting pinged by these things. But it's often better for a recluse to stay alive for a while because there are some advantages to being in those pings and being the recluse in that you can sometimes deduce information from them.
Yeah. And that sort of gets into, like, a storytelling bugaboo of mine, which is the recluse's supposed drawback of registering as evil or as the demon is frequently used by storytellers as effectively like confirmation for the recluse and for the good player who's detecting them. Like, if the recluse always registers as a minion to the investigator and always registers as a demon to the fortune teller and always registers as evil to the empath, those characters always just confirm themselves by picking up on the recluse. Like, and even in the rare case, it's an evil player bluffing as a recluse to, like, the good player still ends up being confirmed by correctly detecting the evil. Which is to say, like, this way of treating the recluse as hard confirmation for, like, good information roles makes the recluse much less interesting to me strategically because there's no drawback you have to work around. Like, your drawback has become a positive.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm actually inclined to slot it pretty low on the tier list because while I do think it has some of the same interesting things to do as something like, you know, maybe like the ogre, maybe it can do some of the same things as a mutant. It also just has that drawback of it doesn't seem to matter what choices you make a lot of the time. It's going to depend on how you play socially. And it might just be that as a recluse, and even as an evil player bluffing recluse, it might just be interesting to play outed recluse. Towns are going to be hesitant to kill you for reasons like there's an oracle, there's a undertaker, there's things, you know, there's a cannibal, there's things that you could disrupt by dying, death information, things like that. You don't necessarily want to out if there's a vigor mortis on script because they can use your body as a potential minion registration to create extra poisons without sacrificing an evil, which is extremely strong. So I do think there's some stuff in there, but I'm not sure how deep the strategy goes.
Yeah, I would say, like, vigor mortis with recluse, like, boosts it up a lot because then the recluse needs to make sure they're not killed at night, specifically.
Yeah.
And figuring out how to try to die in a way, but only at day is more interesting than a lot of the other on deaths, which are just trying to always stay alive no matter what. Trying to stay alive in the day, but not at night, but not be killed at night to counter the vig is really quite interesting.
It's an interesting interaction for sure.
Unfortunately, a lot of the other, like, interesting recluse things are things that sort of create a sour taste. Like, recluses don't want to nominate when town criers are in script and don't want to vote when flower girls are in script.
Yeah.
Which is, I guess, something, but it's also not fun.
It's certainly a drawback. It certainly makes the outsider an outsider.
Yeah.
But I do think it's not fun. And I think recluse is going to go into C tier for me because of that.
Yeah, I think recluse is a good character. I think it's a character that makes sense in a lot of scripts. It certainly is a very important part of making TB hum as a cohesive whole.
Oh, it's.
So I think the strategy for the recluse player is pretty limited.
Yeah, I think the player themselves, it's boosted up maybe a little bit by being an interesting and useful bluff, especially for a demon. and getting away with a Recluse Bluff as the imp on TB is always fun.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think it's probably not deep enough to go much higher than C tier.
All right. Next up is the Saint. If you die by execution, your team loses.
Well, Emma, what do you think about the Saint?
What do I think about the Saint? What do I think about the Saint? The Saint appeals to a lot of people. The Saint doesn't appeal to me. The Saint has one play path, right? The Saint is the play path of they need to avoid being executed because then they lose the game.
I'm just gonna go ahead and put it in C tier here next to the Plague Doctor, and then we can discuss why it needs to go down to D tier, right?
I'm not gonna necessarily. I don't think it needs to go down to D tier, because I think unfortunately it's got a little more variability in what it needs to do compared to Golem and Hatter. So I will reluctantly allow it in C tier. What I feel like I need to defend is, isn't the Saint the same thing as the Goblin, some people say? Isn't the Goblin and the Saint, don't they both say the same thing? Don't execute me, you'll lose. And they do. But the difference is the Goblin is trying to be executed while saying that, and the Saint is actually trying not to be executed. And, like, that difference may seem minor, but, like, that difference turns it from one of the most strategically fascinating characters in the game to one of the most, at least in my view, strategically dullest characters in the game.
I think the way you put it is great. The Goblin needs to say, if you kill me, you'll lose, and then still get killed. The Saint is just threatening, if you kill me, you'll lose, and then continuing to try not to die, right? That's what makes the Goblin play pattern interesting, is that they have to say, tell the town, if you kill me, you're going to lose, and then still get killed.
Yeah. Whereas the Saint needs to say, yeah, it's like, the Saint lacks that second half that makes the Goblin strategically have such high strategic depth, and it leaves it with just, like, there's two types of Saint. The saints who are actually good saints, who are just open about being the saint and, like, being socially good and trying to get the evil team to kill them in the night. And then the evil team doing lazy saint bluffs, who aren't doing all those things and just using saint as an excuse not to get executed. And, I mean, this is a little bit outside of the scope of your this podcast format, but please, please, if the poisoner is bluffing Saint and they're not actually doing the Saint stuff of trying to seem socially good and they just seem evil, you don't have to wait to Final Three to deal with the Saint. If the Saint is evil, you can kill the Saint on day one.
Yep.
Like, sorry, that's a minor rant that is really outside the scope of the strategy of playing as the Saint.
I don't think it is, Emma. I actually think that encouraging people to think about... I'm going to use a word that I don't like to use with Clock Tower, but I'm going to use this word here very specifically. Thinking about better play patterns. That is to say, thinking about play patterns that are going to be more fun, that are going to be more interesting, that are going to be more engaging. Listeners, have you ever tried to just seem good in a game of Blood on the Clock Tower? Because I gotta be honest, about 3/4 into the way of every game that I've ever played, where I'm trying intentionally to seem good, being honest about my role, and about every piece of information, I get executed by the good team for being too obviously good. So I do think there's a lot of fun to be had in just being honest and saying, look guys, I'm the Saint, and I'm gonna try to prove how good I am, so that the evil team is forced to kill me. I think that's a fun play pattern. People don't engage in it, for the most part.
I mean, that is just what Saints should be doing, is you should be trying to seem as good as possible most of the time, so that the demon will be forced to kill you because you're too plainly good. Like,
I mean, I think people lose track of, like, the basic play pattern of Recluse that a lot of people pick up when they very first start playing Blood on the Clock Tower or Butler, which is claim a powerful townsfolk role and try to get killed in the night. It's pretty okay thing to happen, you know? Like, that's an okay play pattern. Saints claiming to be the saint and being believed and socially trusted by everyone is a perfectly okay play pattern.
Yeah. If you're going to bluff saint, you should be trying for that second, that part where you seem socially good and, like, get everyone to trust you as the saint and not just lazily use it as a defense against being executed when evil. And, yeah. And that's enough on that. Next is Snitch. Snitch is, of course, its text is actually in the process of changing. So what's written on the websites and everything isn't right. It's currently written as minions start knowing three non-play characters. That's no longer going to be right. It's going to be minions start knowing three bluffs. Either way, like, I think that change maybe has subtle, like, strategic implications for what Snitch does for the evil team. But it doesn't really matter for Snitch as a character in and of itself. Snitch is the most D-tier of D-tier characters.
Yep, it's going right in D-tier.
Clock Tower doesn't have vanilla villagers. Snitch may as well be a vanilla villager. The drawback is whatever. I don't really care if the minions start knowing three non-in-play characters or not.
It has some additional utility in script building with, like, Magician and Poppy Grower. That's what it's doing, basically.
Yeah.
It's balancing the scales
in Magician and Poppy Grower games. I don't think it really... I don't know if I really even think that's what it does. Like, I don't expect them to be on the same base three. This is the same expansion script as Magician or Poppy Grower. I expect Magician and Poppy Grower to be in one script and Snitch to be in another.
I put a Snitch in a Legion game once, and the Snitch refused to believe that it was a Legion game the entire time, because why would you put a Snitch in a Legion game?
Yeah, I mean, I think Snitch, like, but all these things are about, like, what the evil team can do with it. For the Snitch themselves, okay, I've had a minor drawback that's entirely over. Now I'm just sort of hanging out here as a vanilla outsider, vanilla townsfolk, even. Obviously, like, you know, solving the outsider count part of things is, like, cool and important, and like any other outsider, you want to help the good team solve outsider count if you can.
I guess it has some of the starts knowing role strategy of, like, trying to look like a more powerful role and getting killed to some extent. Like, instead of a, like, I say more powerful role, the Snitch wants to look like a more powerful role than the Snitch, which isn't hard. You know, claiming to be a more damaging outsider or something might be useful, you know, claiming to be a plague doctor or something. But, I mean,
that's an option for any outsider that doesn't have a death consequence. It's just sort of, it is the closest thing to a vanilla character in Blood on the Clock Tower. From the player's perspective, it might as well not have an ability. It goes in D tier, I think.
Yep.
Pretty easily.
I agree with you completely. And that brings us to Sweetheart, which is the last of our Sects and Violets outsider suite. I think it has a lot in common with those.
It's also the last of our negative consequence on death characters. When you die, one player is drunk from now on. It's sort of like an inverse Moonchild, where, like, the Moonchild drawback is, as we discussed in part one, like, the Moonchild drawback is lesser the earlier the Moonchild dies, whereas the Sweetheart drawback is greater the earlier the Sweetheart dies, because towards the end of the game, drunking one good player just isn't going to matter most of the time.
Yeah, the Sweetheart can out mid to late game and probably not have too much impact. A lot, like, of times Sweetheart drunkenness that comes out in the mid to late game is pretty easily trackable as to where it goes. Maybe there's one or two people, there's, like, one or two candidates, and you can solve that. But
within the confines of Sex and Violet, Sweetheart is an excellent Vigor Mortis minion bluff.
Oh, it's a great bluff.
Because the Vigor Mortis can kill their minion who's bluffing Sweetheart, then the Sweetheart can explain away an oracle or math number.
Yep. Which I think is pretty strong and interesting.
Yeah. Which, It's just good. Like, good solid minion play. It's a valuable bluff for a Fangu as well.
Oh, yeah. It's a great bluff for a Fangu who jumps and then says, oh, somebody's drunk now.
I think it's underrated as a bluff for evil players, particularly evil characters that want to die in the night, like Vigor Mortis minions or Fangus or Zombuls or Imps. I think all gain a lot from bluffing a sweetheart.
Yeah, I agree.
And I think sort of like the... I don't know. It probably goes with Plague Doctor and Moonchild. I could talk myself into moving it up, but I think it just has to go with Plague Doctor and Moonchild. It's more similar to Plague Doctor in that it wants that the later it dies, the better.
Yep.
The earlier it dies, the worse.
Yeah. I'm just going to put it actually directly between Plague Doctor and Moonchild, because I do think it's roughly similar. I might shift it up to the top of C tier just because it is a fantastic bluff for any evils that die in the night. It's really useful in that way, but it's not doing a whole lot more than that strategically. And on its own, it's very similar to Moonchild, Plague Doctor, Saint. I might actually move Saint down to the bottom of that tier now that I think about it, because I think the drawback of Saint is also the least interesting strategically.
I am looking at where we are at our sort of distribution, and I do think distribution wise, I do want to argue for moving Moonchild up to B tier.
Okay.
I think like
do you want to revisit it at the end or just do it?
No, we can do it now because I don't think we're gonna have much to say about Tinker and Zealot. I think like the variability of who you should be choosing based on the game state and particularly the number of players alive and what type of demon you think is in play does make the Moonchild more in line with what we have in B tier than what we have in C tier.
Yeah, I actually really like Moonchild as a role, and I was thinking about this the last time too. It does reward one of the things that we talked about, which is paying attention to the Grim, knowing what's on the Grim. And I think we lowered it because of the sort of late game feels bad risk of just, you know, picking a good player and losing the game for your team. But simultaneously, I think, again, having a good Grim read is how you avoid that. And so I do think it rewards engagement with the game.
All right. This brings us to... We have two left, which are Tinker and Zealot. Tinker is, you might die at any time. What do you want to say about the Tinker?
So I want to clarify that we're going to talk about the strategy involved in the Tinker's ability, not its suitability as a general minion. I think a lot of people like the Tinker. I think a lot of people think the Tinker is fun. It doesn't have a ton of, because it doesn't have agency in when it dies largely. It doesn't have a ton of choices to make, so it can be a very relaxing, kind of chill character to pull on BMR, where you're just sort of waiting to see when you die and whether your death is covering a gossip kill or whether it's covering some other extra death in the night thing, or whether you've been killed by the evil team. I do think on BMR specifically, it's important to figure out whether a Tinker death is caused by its own ability if you can. It's an important part of being able to solve BMR, but there's almost no choice in that. And so I think the Tinker goes pretty low tier for me just because it's not able to do a whole lot.
I would sort of push back on that a little bit. I think the Tinker has a very important job in the strategic space of BMR, which is to force the storyteller into a position where the storyteller can't not kill the Tinker on a true gossip. And what do I mean by that? The most devastating thing for the good team is a gossip that is true, a gossip that is valid, being sunk into a Tinker so the Tinker dies in the night and people think the gossip is false because the Tinker died to their own ability. And I think the Tinker has some agency in trying to make that a more painful decision for the storyteller. And I think because BMR is notable for its sort of dearth of hard information, of information. And the gossip is one of the most powerful information roles in the game. And the Tinker's more or less explicit role as an outsider is to mess with gossips.
More or less.
Like, the Tinker needs to think about how they play in relation to the gossip and what's being gossiped, and trying to put the storyteller in a position where the Tinker cannot be used to make false gossips look true or true gossips look false. And I think that puzzle is, for me, enough to get it into B tier.
Into B tier? Interesting.
Yeah.
That requires the Tinker. So the puzzle you're talking about explicitly requires the Tinker to be paying attention to the Grimm, knowing, trying to figure out who the gossip is, doing a lot of the things that the evil team is going to be doing at the same time, which is what makes the evil players interesting to play. I'm just thinking through it.
Putting themselves in a social situation where the storyteller is gonna feel awkward about killing a Tinker.
I was gonna say it goes in C tier. I'm willing to kind of go along down this road with you, for putting it in B tier. In terms
you
of
you should
being
make the anti-Tinker case.
I think I'm willing to go along with putting it in B tier. I will say I think your argument relies heavily on it being in play with the gossip. I think if gossip is not in play, it's not doing that. And I think it does appear on, you know, on other scripts sometimes where I'm not sure it belongs anyway.
I never want to talk about BMR characters outside of BMR because they almost never belong there.
I do think you have almost no agency. The agency you're talking about is fair to discuss in the situation where there's a gossip in play. In the situation where there's no gossip in play, I think it reverts to the... There's not a whole lot for the Tinker to do. They can try to figure out if there's a gossip in play. And so there's some choices to make there, I guess.
You should always be playing like there's a gossip in play because of the two characters' sort of hand-in-handness. I will say if you do find BMR Tinkers outside of BMR, specifically with Pit Eggs, underrated Pit Egg move is to Pit Egg an evil player into the Tinker so they can Tinker die at night in a very confirmed and obvious way.
Yep. I don't disagree with that in any way. I do think that's a kind of fun interaction. I'm willing to go along with you here and move Tinker up to the bottom of B tier, top of C tier general area. I
will also acknowledge, like, I'm trying to, like, keep this as, like, a reasonable-looking curve. And if we put Tinker lower than B tier, we're going to have, like, a curve where that doesn't make sense for the outsiders.
Yeah, that's reasonable. I think it can go at the bottom of B tier, and I'll be satisfied with that. That there is the fact that you were able to pull out at least one really good suggestion of strategic play means to me that it's probably above C tier. And if you've been able to pull out the one, maybe I could think of others if I gave it the time. So I'm willing to give on that one, especially knowing that the only thing left is Zealot, which I think we're both going to agree on pretty hard. So.
Yeah, Zealot is again a super fun character. I really like Zealot. I think also it's underrated how damaging Zealot is. Zealot is effectively an extra evil vote because Zealot votes with the evil team until
especially
final
with Serenovus on the script.
Zealot is, I think, fun. Zealot's interesting. Zealot is a powerful and good outsider. For the player who is the Zealot, though, they are mechanically required to vote on everything.
But Emma, I hear our viewers say, you're about to put the Zealot in D tier. Milk already even put it in D tier. But how can you put the Zealot in D tier and not the Butler?
You can go back and listen to episode the part one of this series about how Butler actually has to make choices. Butler has to get a good grim read on who's going to let them vote on who they want to vote on. Whereas Zealot doesn't get to do any of those things. Zealot just has to vote. It's a restriction that gives you, that incentivizes you to make choices and incentivizes you to use, to get around your drawback versus an ability that doesn't do those things. I do agree Zealot goes in D tier. It's similar to what else we have in D tier, in that it's very one trick.
In terms of using it as a bluff, it's very risky. Towns will kill Zealots.
There's no negative consequence to having the extra vote. Yeah. Evil won't really want to kill Zealots because it is an extra evil vote. So it does, like, give you survivability.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. Mm-hmm. So it's not a great bluff. It's not making any choices. It literally just has to raise its hand.
All right, so let's just recap our outsider tier rankings in S tier for, like, lots of strategic depth threat outsider. We have the Butler, the Damsel, the Lunatic, and the Mutant. I think these are all relatively self-explanatory. They all have choices they need to make to get around their restrictions. And these choices are interesting. These choices, like, are variable. There's different things they can do with them. Butlers can use that their ability as a social alignment checker by picking people they think are evil and then figuring out if they'll let them vote on evil players. Lunatics can try to direct kills at players they want to die. Blah, 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 blah. Then we have our Barber, Heretic, Butler, and Goon. So these are really two categories. Politician and Goon. We have the Barber, who we both think, like, the Barber is, like, so incentivized to learn the Grim State and figure out when is optimal for them to die based off that. The Heretic, Politician, and Goon are all quasi trying to lose, effectively, which is fascinating. Then we have the Puzzle Master, the Drunk, the Klutz, the Ogre, the Moonchild, and the Tinker, all of which are outsiders that, like, they're pretty boxed in, but they're not super boxed in. Like, they have their job, they have their goal, they're incentivized to work hard for that goal. They can go about achieving that goal in different ways.
Four of them make a choice.
Yeah, but they are limited by the goal. The goal is the goal, and except for the Drunk, who doesn't know they're an outsider, and is really dependent on what townsfolk they're looking at. Yep. Down in C tier, we have three of our four Please Don't Kill Me outsiders, Plague Doctor, Sweetheart, Saint. And we also have the Recluse. These characters are just very one note in how they approach things. And then in D tier, we have the Golem, Zealot, Hatter, and Snitch, which are just even more one note and even less strategically interesting. Anything that looks wrong to you, Milk?
No, I don't think anything here looks particularly wrong to me. I think I stand by this, and I think it was interesting ranking the outsiders. I think I learned a little bit about the challenges we're going to face ranking the townsfolk later, in terms of how we think about them. But I think ranking the outsiders in terms of how they play around their drawback or how they have to try to play the game in a different way made me really think about, when I draw outsider tokens, how engaged do I stay? And I think if I look at these rankings that we've given them, I genuinely think that the S tier are the character tokens that when I pull them, I'm the most engaged, and the D tier are the character tokens when I pull them, I'm the least engaged.
I think, yeah, I think that's a great way to think about it. Is I think when you look at these, for the player who draws them, not for what they do for the game overall, for the player who draws them, the strategic depth is related heavily to how much it forces that player to engage with the game, to engage with the socials and mechanics of what other players are doing. And I think from that perspective, the S tier ones are super high and the D tier ones are super low.
This was a really fun exercise, the outsider part of this. I think I found this outsider part more interesting even for me than the minion part, because I think in the minions we kind of generally had a sense of of how that was going to go, more or less. Here, I'm a little bit, I'm not surprised, but I wonder how our viewers and listeners will think of this. I wonder how they'll perceive where we ended up with these. And I'm looking forward to getting that feedback.
Yeah. We've been really enjoying this. It's gotten good feedback. We're going to keep going with our demons. Pretty soon we may do a regular episode in between before we launch the demons or not. We'll almost certainly release the Vegas Live episode before we do the demons.
Yeah, the next one will probably be the Vegas Live episode, followed by the start of demons. I'm wondering how long it's going to take us to get through demons. I hope we can do it in two episodes, but I think it might go longer than that. We'll have to see.
See. Minions and Outsiders both are... We have both the same number of them as we did demons. And they both took us roughly the same amount of time. Two episodes. I am very glad we decided not to try to push through and do all of Outsiders in one leak, like we briefly suggested.
Yeah.
That would have not gone well. It would have been like a two-hour episode.
yeah. And we actually had a lot more to talk about with these than I thought, so I'm really glad we did it this way. I think dividing them into twos hopefully will work for most stuff. I'm nervous about demons just because the demons tend to be the most strategically engaging characters. They have a lot of choices to make. So, you know, we'll see kind of... There are some there that aren't going to have a lot for us to talk about, but there's definitely some that are going to take some time. So we'll just see how it goes.
Yeah.
Don't forget, as I mentioned earlier, grimscenariospodcast@gmail.com. Get in your stories of times and people were kind to you. If you'd like to win a badge to Final 3 Con in Washington, D.C., April 25th through 27th, 2025. That's a contest that's running from the current time to December 6th. And that's, I think, all I've got. How about you, Emma? Anything else you want to say? Last final thoughts?
No, I don't think so. May your scenario stay grim.